Welcome into another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick, and he is Dan, joining us again back on the podcast. It's been a little bit.
Yeah, I just want to clarify for the folks out there, this was not like a Bill Simmons situation where I demanded additional monies or concessions from Snow and Rick to continue doing the podcast or through like a fit or something. I don't even know.
I just
recorded at times that were inconvenient for me.
Yeah, and then Snow and I kind of just got in the groove with the recruiting. I needed Snow for some of the recruiting stuff in general just because he had a better feel for some of it. And then we got into that little player preview stuff, and it was rolling well, so we stuck with him. But, you are
also
back.
Also, Snow will never miss a opportunity to listen to himself talk, obviously.
That's a great point. Or eat, for that matter. Or listen to his dog bark. It's been a great soundtrack to listen to Snow on the podcast recently. Listeners, I know, have enjoyed hearing playing Guess What Snow's Having for Dinner or, Guess Who's Coming Up to the Door While Snow's Dog is Barking. It's been a good time. So let's get into some, obviously the big news, Dan. Wednesday morning, the news broke that Eddie Ekior had committed. And let's just start here because, obviously, we don't need to talk about his game a whole lot. Brian and I have kind of talked that into the ground already on the previous few podcasts. But I assume you've been following this kind of all along as it's been going on. What's been your thought about just adding, another 6'9" athletic but unskilled big to the roster in general?
Well, I think that there are a couple interesting or out of the ordinary things here. First of all, I think this is probably the first true international player that Xavier's brought in quite a long time. I can't remember them having another player from Canada. Maybe Jeff Massey was originally from Canada, but it's been a long time since Xavier recruited somebody who comes from an international background. So that's kind of interesting. And obviously they were in with Singular a few years ago, but that didn't take. So that's one kind of weird angle to this. I think the other thing is the early enrollment aspect of it. Ekior's going to start as Xavier at Christmas break and enroll for the second semester this year. That's not uncommon in the football realm, from what I understand. A lot of you'll hear about that quite a bit with football recruits who have finished up their mandatory classes in high school coming and enrolling at the winter break before their freshman year of eligibility. But it doesn't seem to happen that often in the basketball realm, and I guess that's because of the way the Canadian education system links up with the American. It doesn't really mesh perfectly. But in terms of his game, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that much. I mean, X's biggest weakness, I think, last year, and you guys talked about this quite a bit, especially when you think about that second St. John's game at Madison Square Garden, where it was just St. John's athletes were just superior to Xavier's athletes. And I think you saw it again in the Arizona game in the Sweet 16, that teams that could just come at Xavier with athleticism could just overwhelm them. I think Villanova had a little bit of that too. Although they have a lot of guys that's kind of old man game, they have a lot of guys who are long, who can play multiple positions, a lot of skill on the wing that can kind of overwhelm Xavier. And I think that that's something that Xavier's looking at and saying, we need to get more athletic. And I think that's why you look at a high ceiling guy with size like Quentin Good, and you look at a relentless defensive rebounder athlete like Tyree Jones, and Ekior maybe fits that mold too. Also, you're going to have him for a 6-month period here where he's going to be not playing. He's going to be redshirting, so he'll get basically a full year of seasoning in the system. And then even next year, which you've talked about at some length, they're going to have Rasheed Gaston, they're going to have Sean O'Mara, they're going to have some other options, McKinsey London, conceivably Kaiser Gates. They're going to have some various options that are going to be ahead of them in the pecking order. So this is a guy that could be a sort of a 2-year project for the staff. So, maybe he's not quite as unskilled as we're viewing him now by the time he actually sees the floor for significant minutes. So I think it's a gamble worth taking. I mean, you're talking about a 3-star kid, number 25 center in the class. And, you know, it, as you and Snow, I think, talked about, this again is a class where Xavier is not in a position where they need to get a whole bunch of players. This isn't like the Trayvon JP class where they just needed to add a huge amount of talent in a number of different positions. They can take a flyer on a guy or two. So I think this is one that's going to be a slow burner. But certainly you look at this kid's pedigree. I mean, he's represented Canada at international level. He was on the team at the World University Games in Dubai in 2014. He was among 24 players that were named to the first, I think it's called the BioSteel All-Canadian Game, which I guess is their equivalent to the McDonald's All-America Game. And certainly we've seen at the NBA level, at the collegiate level, over the last 5 years, a massive influx of Canadian talent in the game. So I think there are a lot of fascinating things about this recruitment. Anything stick out to you?
Well, yeah. I think one of the things that you just brought up was actually an interesting point in that, you know, 2 years from now, potentially, when he's really asked to make an impact on this team, he might not be as unskilled as we're talking about. I think that's a good point, because out of the two, out of Tyreek and Eddie, it does sound like Eddie is a little bit more polished, has a little bit more skill, and certainly understands how to play the game a little bit more on the offensive end in terms of just, you know, understanding how to cut, how to play off other players in the post, how to high-low, how to pass, all of those things. He understands a little bit better and is a little bit more advanced than Tyreek, from what I understand. And so it brings up this interesting thing of, like, I think it's part of, a lot of it has to do with probably Snow and my tone when we have talked about Ekior leading up to things, because it was, they already have Tyreek if they're going to get another big. And I'm talking about, you know, earlier on towards the end of summer, entering this fall recruiting period, when we were talking about how things may go, and this is when Dylan Painter and Torian Thompson were still very much options. We kind of said it as like, well, you know, Eddie Ekior is a guy they're targeting, but he's very similar to Tyreek, so it's one of these two other guys are probably going to be the ideal choice. And I still believe adding someone who would have been different from Tyreek, you know, a center who was more of a face-up guy like a Dylan Painter or a Torian Thompson, would have been maybe the more ideal option for Xavier's staff, and would have just covered more ground with this recruiting class and given you a little bit more, even more versatility and different pieces to work with. However, if someone were to tell you at the same time, if Brian and I would have said, hey, they're going after this guy who they may feel is even more advanced and more ready than Tyreek Jones to come in and contribute right away and is a very similar player, I think most people would have really been on board with that. And that's kind of, you know, the case from what I understand. Like, everyone's really excited about getting Tyreek and how athletic and everything he is. And I hear, you know, they feel that Ekior might be even more ready to play right away when he gets on campus. And not to mention, he's going to now have this whole redshirt half of the, you know, the rest of the season after Christmas break. He's going to get to learn the system. He's going to get to work out with the team. And not to mention, have a pretty significant workout period leading up to the time that he's going to redshirt. So he's going to be in a really good position in terms of being ready to go right away when practice starts in October before next season. And then even then, when you have, you know, Rashid Gaston and Kaiser Gates and Sean O'Mara and all those guys still to rely on, you may not need them. So there is going to be a ton of development before Xavier is asking for much out of Eddie Ekior. And who knows, he may be able to give it to give them something before that. So I just think it's going to be really interesting to see how competitive practices are next year when you have all these big men that can play. I mean, Rashid Gaston is known as a physical, strong dude. I mean, you can see it just looking at him. Now I went up for workouts on Tuesday, and, you know, he's a well-put-together guy. You got him and Sean going at it in the paint. You got Kaiser and McKinday, who at that point you would expect to be, you know, a little more physical and scrapping, competing for minutes. And you add two more guys who are just brutes in the paint, and Eddie and Tyreek, who like to do all the dirty work and get after it. Practices next year in the paint are going to be, I think, extraordinarily competitive and physical.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt about that. And another thing is, I think sometimes when you talk about bringing in a kid who's raw, there's a tendency to think, well, you know, there's a tendency to remember maybe some of those guys that have come in with that reputation and never really reach their potential. You know, you think about maybe like a Jeff Robinson type who kind of was the super athlete, but maybe didn't know the game that well when he showed up and showed flashes of being a brilliant player, but never really got to that point on any kind of consistent basis. But there have been plenty of counterexamples of guys that have come into Xavier that it have looked like they've never seen a basketball court before for a year or two and then turned into really solid contributors. Here you've got a guy that's not even going to be asked to get on the floor for probably a period of about 18 months. And if he does, will be in relatively limited minutes. And I think you're really setting yourself up well. The other nice thing is that, like you said, he's going to have the opportunity this year. He's going to be practicing not only with Jalen and James, but also with Rashid Gaston, which means he's going to get a rude awakening to the physical side of the game if he's not ready for it. So certainly you would expect it not to be a huge surprise to him when he does get into full contact next season that it won't come as a massive surprise, I guess, to him, having had that experience in practice for 6 months or whatever it'll be. Rick, there is one other issue we need.
Dan, let me be clear. Let me hit on one more point, too. Let me be clear because and I haven't seen Ekior as much. I've made that clear. I have not. I've only watched him in one game, period. Most of my information is coming more from sources and guys that have watched him more, but and talking about, you know, how the staff feels about him. But from what I understand, to be clear, I don't think Ekior is seen as a real raw guy. Like, I don't think he's seen as a project. Taurean Thompson was very much seen in that mold. Even though he was a more face-up and skilled player, he was very much a project and just scratching the surface of his potential. I think they feel like Ekior is more college-ready and not necessarily raw in terms of his potential and in terms of his game, but just that he's unskilled. He's not a shooter. He's not, you know, he's not a stretch four. He just knows what he is. He's a dunker. He's an around-the-rim, do-the-dirty-work rebounder. But I think, like I've said, they feel like he knows how to play and is more of a polished player than some of the other bigs that they've brought in, you know, specifically like Tyreek Jones, who they're going to bring in with him. So just to be clear, like, I think there is a differentiation between a raw player and an unskilled player, and I think Ekior is more the latter.
Well, I think we would be remiss to not discuss the legal issue that's ongoing involving Eddie Ekior, although I do want to stress that neither of us know anything about Canadian law. We don't really know where things stand as it is right now. By all accounts, the kid's a smart kid, good kid, doesn't get into trouble. But you know, according to the reports and so forth, he did have a pretty significant lapse of judgment where he was involved in an accident where he struck a bicyclist and left the scene of the accident. He was arrested in early August, charged with leaving the scene of the accident, criminal negligence, and apparently was due in court in late August, but that didn't go forward. So we don't really know, and I actually did some research checking like the CBC and some of the Ottawa papers to see if there's any update on where that stood, and I really haven't seen anything. So, I mean, do you get the impression that this is a concern, or is this something that's likely to be resolved through the system and won't necessarily affect his ability to enroll in December?
No, I mean, I think, you know, he's fully expecting to enroll in December at whatever college he was going to commit to. And, you know, all the schools that recruited him were working with him and his lawyers throughout this process. So, you know, I don't think there's really any updates or anything like that. I don't know that we'll hear much, but there were some logistical things that still needed to be sorted out. I know that, which is, again, you know, to break down what all is going on with this stuff when these types of things, news breaks like this, and we're trying to relay information. There was a reason that it hadn't been announced and it wasn't going to be announced already and why we hadn't run with it. He committed before this past weekend to the Xavier staff. And it just wasn't going to be announced, which was part of the, you know, he didn't want it out there yet. So when, you know, when kids want to make their own announcements on their own terms, we'll allow them to do that. And we're, you know, just that's sort of where things stood as of this weekend. So when it was all like talked about, you know, Chris Mack was trying to decide something or leverage things that he had already committed by that point. All of that was completely a non-factor in all of this. It was just a matter of getting some logistical things. And again, he's enrolling mid-semester, so there were some things that had to be figured out with all of that that they wanted to get through before everything was announced. And you still haven't seen any quotes from Eddie. So, you know, I think once everything is resolved, there'll be a little bit more that comes out, and he'll probably comment on his commitment. But until then, I think things are going to be pretty quiet, and we'll just have to wait to hear. But I don't think expect any of that to be an issue for him in terms of enrolling or playing going forward.
Yeah, and I think maybe what people need to realize is that Scout, you and Snow, at least, have a sort of, you've expressed this philosophy on several occasions that you feel like a kid should be allowed to make the announcement on his own terms. But sometimes I think the reality is, especially now with Twitter, social media, et cetera, that decision may get out through channels that aren't through the kid or that the kid has authorized. And those of you listening can make whatever assumptions you want to make with that, but just to say that it may not come from the school or the kids' camp. It may come from other interested parties.
Which was the case here.
And so as a result, you know, it's kind of one of those things where you guys stick to your guns in your philosophy, so to speak, but it may lead to it almost looking like you guys get scooped when that may not really be the issue. It's more an attempt to respect the kid, whereas some other parties may not have that same incentive, I guess. I'm trying to be diplomatic with how I'm saying that.
Right.
Was that sufficiently diplomatic?
It was sufficiently diplomatic for me. And I think, again, it's you know, it's unfortunate. Like, I don't like being in that position where I basically, you know, have to hold something back a little bit. But in those cases, we usually do a pretty good job, I think, of indicating, and most of the people that have been on the board for a while and understand how we work, were able to deduce the fact that this kid was going to commit to Xavier. You know, like, Xavier had this one wrapped up before it was announced. And that's what we try to do in these scenarios, is make it clear that Xavier is in the right spot. Things are going to work out for them. And hopefully you guys can draw those conclusions up leading up to the announcement. But if you're looking for a 3-minute head start on Twitter, you know, we won't always be able to offer that. And I apologize.
Fair enough. Okay. So anything else about Eddie Ecu or his commitment that you think is worth talking about, or should we move on to other pressing matters?
Snow and I have discussed it so much at this point, I don't think there's a whole lot else to say about his game or what he brings, but you know, I think it was a nice ad, and it did, you know, it is seen, you know, by most of the scouts, the scouting service and everything. It has given Xavier a nice bump if they're counting him towards the 2016 class. I know Snow and Evan moved Xavier back into the top 25 team rankings, so it's considered a nice addition. I think it's going to work out well for them going forward, and if nothing else, they're going to have some serious wiggle room in the post. If they miss on a guy or two, they're going to be in good shape because they've got enough bodies down there that one or two of those guys are going to have to pan out, you would think.
So can I lay a couple takes on you regarding the 2016 class? Okay. So first of all, this summer, this recruiting cycle, I guess, with the sort of three-headed monster, the Kobe Simmons, Xavier Simpson, I should say, Quentin Gooden drama, the sort of out of nowhere Tyreek Jones edition, then this latest postman thing. I think this has been one of the more interesting, I use the word interesting too often, but one of the more fun recruiting summers to follow, because it seemed to have a little bit of everything. And there seemed to be a lot of like tactical chess match type wrangling as they tried to determine which combinations of players would work together best, which combinations would fit. And there was a lot of game theory being employed too, you know, the sort of brinksmanship about, well, would we accept the commitment from Xavier Simpson when we know that Quentin Gooden is scheduled to visit? You know, do we continue to recruit Kobe Simmons, et cetera? So I think this has been kind of a cool summer and delightfully drama free by the same token. I mean, it's all been news for good reasons. It's not been guys getting kicked out of school or transferring away or, you know, lots of whispers about untoward occurrences on campus or whatever else. It's been a relatively drama-free offseason for the Xavier program, which I think is a good thing.
And they weren't deciding
especially after some of this.
They weren't deciding between two-star recruits too. Like, it wasn't coming down to last options when you talk about sort of the recruiting drama that made this kind of a fun summer. So that also helped, I think, for fans. The fact that they were good situations to be in. Oh, do we have to quit recruiting this 5-star because we know we have a 4-star? Okay. You know what I mean? Like, it was good problems to have for Xavier.
So second take is I feel like Xavier, and maybe it's because of the comedy for the most part in the staff with Pegues and Steele being around for multiple years now, you know, it seems like the tradition, the transition from Rick Carter over to Luke Murray has gone really well. Chris has been here now, I guess it's what, a seventh year coming up. It seems like they have kind of over the last 2 or 3 years really settled into a groove. And they have, I think, more of an understanding of what their identity is in the world of college basketball and what guys they should be targeting. I feel like early in Chris's tenure at Xavier, there was less of that. I feel like they made some reaches on some guys that just really, once they showed up on campus, you knew had no chance of succeeding at Xavier. While at the same time they were involved in some of these, like, you know, Chris Thomas or Michael Chandler, guys that probably they shouldn't, they probably were available to Xavier for reasons that were not good or should have been red flags. So I think it's kind of interesting how they've found, like, the niche that they inhabit in this world, and they're really doing a nice job, in my opinion, of focusing in on those kids that they can get. And, you know, maybe a little bit of a reach here and there. But, I mean, it would have come as no huge surprise if they'd have come out of this recruiting class with, say, Xavier Simpson instead of Quentin Gooden and Tarian Thompson, or Dylan Painter instead of Eddie Ekior. I mean, it wouldn't have felt like a huge reach if that had happened. I mean, their targets were realistic and were high quality for the kind of basketball that they want to play and for the level of talent that they need to be bringing in. So I think these are really good signs. And I do think that there is, you know, I was listening to your guy, Paul Daner, doing his, the Bengals beat writer podcast. And one of the things he was preaching before the season is don't be surprised if the Bengals come out hot because they have so much continuity. Like the team, the core of their offense and their defense has really been together for 3-4 years, whereas other teams are trying to integrate new players. And I think Xavier's now gotten into this thing where there's a momentum inside the program. They're not having to rebuild and turn over half the roster every other season or every season. It's they know who they are. They've got an identity. They know which guys they want to go after, and they're doing a nice job of identifying those prospects early and moving on them. So I think that has been another theme that I've noticed this summer. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I think that's something that probably comes with just experience and confidence as a head coach in general. I think a lot of that has to do with Chris Mack and how he continues. And I mean, don't get me wrong, the assistants play a huge, huge role in recruiting. But I think in terms of knowing what guys and what fits your system and that you have more of a plan in place, like you were talking about, okay, we've seen what the Big East holds for us, and we've seen what we're going to be going up against, and we've seen what gives us trouble. And so, you know, we felt we need to add a lot of skill, and that was true, and we did that. But now there needs to be some athleticism and toughness mixed back into the roster, and I think they've got an infusion of both of those things with the 2016 recruiting class. So I think absolutely there's been a bit more of a plan, and they've just got a better approach in general to recruiting. And you mentioned the transition from Rick Carter to Luke Murray, and I think just looking at Luke Murray coming in and as a first-year assistant coach, grabbing two, Tyreek Jones and Eddie Ekior, both his recruits, getting two guys. I mean, a lot of times I don't really expect an assistant coach to even make an impact on that first recruiting class that he's helping out with. And already Luke Murray nailing two guys, and two guys that I, from everything I hear and have seen, I think are going to be, you know, solid contributors at the Big East level. Pretty impressive work in what he's done in just a limited time here since he's been at Xavier.
Well, and in fairness, you know, Rick Carter brought in Makura very shortly after he joined the staff. So,
he did.
I mean, it's been both of those guys. And obviously, you know, Rick Carter's moved on to DePaul, associate head coach job, significant raise. I mean, obviously, he's pretty well thought of, too. So Chris has done a nice. So Chris is bringing in, you know, we've seen some assistant churn over the last half dozen years or thereabouts. But all the guys that have come through here have continued to have success and are highly sought after. And certainly, as Snow says, if nobody's come to poach your assistants probably aren't very good. So, I mean, I think that's my view. I mean, I don't know where, you know, I know that people get interested in ranking recruiting classes. If you're a top 20 recruiting class, top 25 recruiting class. I think it's interesting academically, but I it doesn't really matter to me. I think the real assessment of a class is what do you need and what did you get to fill those holes? And you can't just think about who the high school prospects are. You have to look at who the transfers are. You need to look at how your scholarships line up. Xavier's not like a Kentucky that has 8 scholarships to fill every year. So it's not like they can just go hunting, you know, multiple high-rated prospects. They have to be more surgical. I mean, last year they only brought in 1 recruit in Kaiser Gates, and this year they'll have, I guess, 3. It seems like a class that fits the needs that Xavier has, as demonstrated by some of the things that they struggled with last year. I do think, and one thing that I think, as much as we all love Matt Stainbrook, I do think the era of the sort of ponderous, back-to-the-basket, skilled center at Xavier may be over for a while, because I just don't know that even an extraordinary player like Stainbrook, I just don't know that that's the right kind of big man to succeed in the Big East in the next 3-4 years.
I don't know if it's the right type of big man to succeed in basketball, period, right now. I mean, you just look at the NBA, college, everywhere, even high school levels, you know, the way a lot of teams are playing and so much ball screen stuff being implemented, making big men guard away from the rim, it's just very tough. You have to give up so much on the defensive end if you're going to play a big, immobile, space-eating big man. To that, I think you have to get one that has such an extraordinary skill level or is so good on the block. You know, Matt Stainbrook was a unique player and had special abilities that allowed Xavier to keep him on the court and play with him despite what they were giving up defensively, which was a ton. But with that being said, I think Chris Mack will continue to do that, and he has a little bit of an edge now too, because he's shown he can make an offense work with that type of big man. He's shown he can get that type of talent to succeed at the Big East level. So I think, you know, I agree with what you're saying, that they're not going to go out and look for that type of big man, and it's going to have to be a really unique talent to get one. At the same time, I look at the 2018 class. E.J. Williams from Middletown is a guy that they're certainly after, is one of their top targets in the younger grades, and a local kid. And I think he is another guy that he quite honestly reminds me a lot of Stainbrook, a super passer, a really skilled big man that just is going to have to do a ton of work on his conditioning and his body to be able to play, you know, high major Division I basketball. But if it is a guy like that, where he has that type of potential, I think they'll still take their shot with him. It's just going to have to really be a unique player.
Right, and the game is cyclical. I mean, it may well be that 2 or 3 years from now we're seeing a move back toward that style. You know, there may be rule changes about that limit the effectiveness of the ball screen offense. You never know. So we'll see how that goes. But Rick, I did want to, I would be remiss if I didn't, I think the people like us to give a little color about some of the things that we do. So I went to the Cavs Hawks game at CentOS Center, last night. And it was awesome, I have to say. I've only been to 2 NBA games in my life, and this obviously was my first preseason game. And the game itself, I mean, there were some kind of funny things about the game, but the atmosphere around the CentOS Center, that was sort of my first, my first real exposure to sort of the celebrity culture of sports in a long time. You had Floyd Mayweather was there, which
right.
Was insane to me. You know, a huge number of Bengals celebrities. Tom Jackson, of course, was there also, who looked really relaxed and happy not to be listening to Chris Berman yell in his ear. And then when I went down to get a beer at halftime, I found myself standing right next to Billy Hamilton and Carlos Dunlap. So
Adrian Broner was there.
Cincinnati celebrities were all over the place that night. And it's great exposure, obviously, for the school, the the whole LeBron selfie in the third quarter was pretty hilarious. My two takeaways from the game itself, which generally is pretty dreadful, was first, Richard Jefferson just exploded for a tomahawk dunk in the third quarter. And immediately, so my friend and I, we were sitting there, you know, college buddy, we were going back and forth about how old Richard Jefferson was and how amazing it was he could jump out of his wheelchair and deliver a thunderous jam. And then I happened to look at the roster, and Richard Jefferson is actually 2 years younger than me.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that says. But the other thing was that the Cavs they do this line change in the first quarter. They bring in this dude. So they bring in Barishow and Belvedova and the rest of the PFT commenter crew. And then they brought in this other guy, this big, gangly white dude who had kind of a paunch. And I honestly thought this guy was so bad at basketball that I thought it was like a lucky fan had won a contest to play a preseason game with the Cavs. And it turns out that it was Sasha Kahn, who was the backup center for the Kansas National Championship team in 2008, the Mario Chalmers team, and who apparently retired from the Russian League this summer. So all I can figure, Rick, is that David Blatt owes some money to a Russian mobster who is related to Sasha Kahn, because there was no other reason why this guy should have been playing in NBA colors. But that was sort of my takeaway. The other thing, big kudos to Mario Mercurio and the rest of the CentOS Center staff for implementing, I think, something that I brought up on this podcast like 2 years ago, and I'm going to take complete credit for it, which is that they ripped out a couple of rows at the back of Section 200, and they expanded the craft beer bar so it's bigger. So there's more room to stand up there behind the rail, which was something I know I brought up on this podcast because it used to get real congested up there. And it is pretty awesome up there now. I can definitely see myself standing up that rail and watching a few first halves this upcoming season. So, you know, one of the cool things, and Mario talked about this when we had him on last month, is that they are constantly trying to make small incremental improvements to the CentOS Center, and that is definitely one that I personally have enjoyed.
Yeah, and one of the things that we just talked about on that podcast with Mario was just how they've tried to make CentOS the place. You know, that make it a place for celebrity sightings and build that atmosphere. And I think that you really saw that with this Cavs-Hawks game. I was amazed at how much a preseason NBA game took over the night on Cincinnati social media. I mean, I saw mostly, I think, you know, like playoff baseball stuff from national follows, but all of the local people that I followed seemed to be talking about the Cavs-Hawks game and the celebrities that were being spotted in the CentOS, and then LeBron's selfie. And, you know, there were stories up on all types of blogs and stuff talking about the CentOS Center and LeBron being there and all the stuff that was going on there. And I just, you know, I thought, I was like, they do this so well. They're so smart about how they market CentOS and Xavier to the community of Cincinnati and in general. They just make it the place to be and make it synonymous. And I still, like, you know, no one will ever admit this, but I still think putting that Cincinnati skyline on the court was a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of a thumping of the chest in a certain way of saying we are this city's program and this city's college. Yeah. Like, no one will convince me otherwise that there wasn't a little bit of pride there when they did that. And it may seem, you know, kind of like a cliche thing, because a lot of schools have that on their, you know, have that that look to their court now. But here I think it means a little bit more when you don't have the city's name in your college and you're out here saying we're this city's, you know, school. I think it means something.
Because most of the places that do that are like the University of Memphis or the University of Louisville.
Exactly.
Where it sort of goes without saying that that's the city's team. But the other thing is the question that we were asking as we walked out was, just because of the energy in the place and the obvious demand there was, would an NBA team work in Cincinnati? I still am very skeptical of that. But what I do think would work is like a situation like in the old ABA, when the Colonels were in Louisville, they would play like six games a year in Lexington at Rupp Arena and like six games in Cincinnati every year. And I think something like that could potentially be like would potentially be a huge success in Cincinnati. Now, obviously, it would require serious renovations to U.S. Bank Arena or a massive expansion of Cintas Center. But I don't know. That kind of strikes me. I don't think Cincinnati could support an NBA team itself.
I just don't know. Would a team like the Cavs or something, would they give those opportunities up, though? I mean, would they give up 6 home games in this day and age?
I don't know. I really don't know.
I couldn't see a team doing that in 2015. That just doesn't seem like, you know, I think it was a different era back then. I just think from a competitive standpoint and probably a money standpoint, they aren't giving up 6 home games to do a traveling thing like that. I think the preseason is the best you can ask for in that circumstance. But you bring up an interesting point about whether an NBA team can survive, and I would have always said no, but I still go back to it. I was amazed. Again, this was a preseason game. Like, who cares at all about this game? And yet everyone seemed to be talking about it last night. Now, granted, I follow people who are interested in sports, clearly, on Twitter and Facebook and stuff, but I saw it everywhere last night. It really did take over. It felt big to me. It felt like a big Cincinnati event. I think that at the end of the day, if you know, Mo Egger brought up this point today on his show, that if you have, you know, an Eastern Conference NBA team, you're going to see LeBron X number of times come to your city every year. That is going to bring out fans in itself, just bringing the best players in the world there a couple times a year. I do think there would be more of a fan base for an NBA team here than most people think, but at the same time, end of the day, it's never going to happen. I mean, it's really not even worth talking about. I just don't think it'll ever get enough momentum in this city to happen.
That being said, I do think Louisville will. I think there will be a team in Louisville at some point. I think just
I hope
with
so.
The facility and the financial support and everything else, it just makes a great deal of sense. And it would be a lot easier for me if I was going to sort of adopt an NBA team, if it was like a Louisville team that would be kind of new would be easier for me to sort of get all in on than, you know, try and jump on the Pacers or Cavs bandwagon at this point.
Right.
But in any event,
there was also a pretty cool picture I saw floating around today on the internet with James Posey talking to Farr, Reynolds, in London after Xavier's workout yesterday. I thought that was pretty neat.
Yeah, I mean, there were pictures on social media today that the Hawks stayed over this morning and worked out in Xavier's auxiliary gym. So there are all these pictures of, you know, and it just, and, you know, you see all the Xavier branding and everything else. And I mean, I think all that is a little bit overrated, but still it's a lot of, it's good exposure. And it felt like an event. It felt like the place to be last night, which is pretty cool. You don't often get that. You get that at Bengals games, but don't often get that at the Reds other than opening day. And on occasion, you know, when there's a big series or something like that, when the team's halfway decent.
Right.
But that was an example. And I will say that the event feeling of a Xavier game has increased so dramatically since they moved to the Big East. And when you look at this year with the shootout, with the Big East schedule and some of the huge games that they're going to have, particularly toward the end of the Big East season, it's going to be like that again this year. So I'm very much looking forward to this season. Hopefully we'll have a little bit more intelligent discussion to have about, hopefully we'll get to a practice pretty soon and be able to give a little bit more intelligent discussion about how things are looking. But Rick, you texted me earlier with anybody that has followed us. I think this is our fifth season doing this podcast, or fourth season.
Yeah, I was thinking third or fourth. I don't think it's quite fifth yet.
I think it's the fourth season. So you all know that Rick and I are great aficionados of popcorn at the game. And you came hard with like a popcorn ranking take.
Yes.
Would you care to share that with the people?
Yeah, so today I text you with the definitive popcorn rankings that I've come up with. Just power rankings for really any type of edible popcorn that one might come across. And I had it, and the reason I did post this is because my brother had given me a bag of kettle corn from some type of weird fair he went to out off the AA highway or whatever. And I don't know, you're familiar with kettle corn, I assume, Dan?
Oh, sure.
I immediately just realized how f***ing good kettle corn is. So I came up with the rankings, and I had kettle corn number one, obviously, followed closely at number two by stadium popcorn. I would hope you could all get behind this so far. Number three, I had white cheddar, you know, smart food, the black bag, white cheddar popcorn. That would be my number three. And four, I would put microwave normal butter popcorn in. After that, I had cheddar popcorn. You know, like you get the big tins, like they come from that place in Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah, the tri, the cardboard in the middle, and you get the cheddar pop. I like the, you know, cheddar. I would have that five. And then I didn't, you know, I don't, maybe there's other options. I don't know. But no matter what other options there are, last is absolutely caramel corn. Caramel corn sucks.
So, first of all, strong take. I admire your commitment to coming hard. Here's my issue with kettle corn. Part of the reason why I like popcorn is it's a grazing snack, right? Like you get the bag at Cintas Center. It's the size of like your entire seat.
Yes.
So it's sort of something you can have sitting on the ground. You reach down, you get a handful. You can work on it over the course of about 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I am not convinced that with a heavier sugared popcorn, like a kettle corn or a caramel corn, that you can do that for that amount of time. First of all, because you'll ingest literally 100,000 calories. Secondly, it'll just make you full and kind of leaden. And part of the thing with the popcorn is it's got to interact well with the beverage.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not sure that I want to sit there and eat a sugary snack while I'm drinking an IPA.
Well,
Bud Light.
That's a good point. I mean, it's probably not what you're getting at a basketball game for sure. I don't know that it's the best event snack.
But I don't eat popcorn when I'm not at sporting events.
It's
a special sporting event treat for me.
Yeah,
so that is a good point. The only times I eat popcorn are at a sporting event or when I'm at the office and they get one of the giant things with the picture of Santa Claus on the side that has the peace sign with the three different kinds of popcorn. And then if I'm getting popcorn out of that, obviously I'm probably going with the cheddar first, followed by maybe the caramel corn if it's like after lunch and I want something a little sweet. The standard popcorn in those, it just doesn't really do that much for me.
Yeah,
so,
it's just okay.
So
I
have some subtle disagreements with your rankings, but I don't think you're completely off base. I will say, you know, I think that popcorn is going to remain my go-to meal at the game because I just am not the type of person that can sit still long enough to eat like a hot dog or something during the game.
Yeah.
But the one thing that I am kind of getting more and more concerned by is I end up getting Bengals tickets a lot, and there are no good food options at Paul Brown Stadium. I just can't figure out why this state of affairs exists. I mean, there is nothing there that's even edible. So that is my biggest complaint about going to Bengals games these days. The product on the field this year, obviously, I have no complaints about whatsoever. But you know, we'll see. We'll see. The afternoon, Andy faces his sternest test yet this weekend against Seattle. What are your thoughts on the Bengals? I mean, obviously 4-0, they've covered four times. They're obviously playing ridiculously well on offense. Do you have, like, what is your, as a Bengals fan, you obviously are waiting for the other shoe to drop. Like,
yes.
What do you view, what is the potential disaster that leads you to see them, like, maybe missing the playoffs or being an also-ran again this year?
Well, see, I think they're making the playoffs. I think that much is clear. They're really good. They're really talented. Last year, they were derailed by injuries to where they didn't even have a chance in that playoff game. And, you know, I think Andy, in a lot of ways, was unfair judged for that game when there was just literally no one alongside him to play with. So
Rex
Burkhead
was his number one
right,
wide receiver.
Right. I don't put that loss on him necessarily. The only interesting storyline during this regular season to me right now really is, is it possible that Andy Dalton has added something to his game? And obviously that something is the little bit of improvisational skills and the ability to not freak out when someone's in his face and all of a sudden still make a play out of it or just get rid of the ball without taking a sack or throwing an interception, as he's shown a propensity for in the past.
In the Kansas City game, he did two things that I've never seen him do before.
And that's how I feel, too.
The most important plays of the game. There was that 3rd-and-2, I think on the first drive, where it was like a low snap, where at any point in the last 4 years, he would have just reached down, gotten the ball, and run up the middle and not gotten the first down. This time he gets up and throws an absolute BB right on Green's hands 40 yards down the field. And then the second time he gets the pocket collapses for one of the few times all game, and I think the offensive line play is the number one reason why he's looked so good. But he gets outside the pocket and throws an absolute dart to podcast favorite Brandon Tate, who makes an absolutely incredible catch and gets in the end zone for a key touchdown. when Kansas City was kind of
had momentum,
it was moving at a glacial pace, getting back into the game.
Yeah.
Now, granted, Andy Reid was definitely playing for like 9 straight field goals in the second half. Like he had a very, he was playing the long game against Marvin in the second half. And so all they need, you know, if Kansas City had gotten the ball like 10 or 11 more times in the second half, they probably would have had a chance. But yeah, I mean, I'm seeing that. But I mean, what it continues to come down to for me, Rick, is that for the Bengals, like, let's assume that everything goes well. Let's say the Bengals win 12 games this year and get a bye and then win a playoff game.
Mm-hmm.
Can Marvin Lewis win a game against the New England Patriots at Foxborough, coached by Bill Belichick, quarterback by Tom Brady? I remain dubious.
Yeah, but, I mean, there's a lot of questions, a lot of things they still have to prove. But to me, the question still comes down to Andy has been mercurial in the past. He's always had these great stretches. So him playing really well just wasn't really impressing me, and it still isn't. But the few plays that we've seen, the plays you're referencing, I can't recall seeing those types of things in the past. Now, maybe it's possible that he's done it a few times, and then he gets in a primetime game, completely loses it, plays horribly, and we forget about any good things he's done before that. But I don't recall seeing him do a few of the things he's done this year, and that's my big, the reason for hope as a Bengals fan is, if it's possible, he's added this little bit to his game. Now, one of the big things you brought up is the offensive line play, and that's another reason I'm so confident they'll make the playoffs, because right now, the way this offensive line is playing, as long as they don't get injured, he's not going to see enough pressure for him to really have these terrible games that he's had in the past, I don't think. I think they're going to keep him clean enough to where he's going to be fine. But at some point, it's going to matter in the playoffs. You know, he's going to be tested, and then that it becomes that. Can he be cool enough under pressure in a primetime game when it matters to make these same plays that we saw, you know, the ones you referenced against KC specifically?
So there was one, and then, you know, when you talk about the offensive line play and some of the weapons this year. So last year, I had tickets for the Jacksonville game, and we were sitting up top because I got them through work. They were discounted. And there was a dude up there who had one of my favorite customized jerseys that I've ever seen at a football game, and anybody who is a big time Bengals fan would get this. It was the number 74, and the nameplate said eligible from the I guess the Dennis Rowland era,
yeah,
where he used to always come in as tackle eligible tight end and would report eligible. And then in that, and so I thought of this guy during the San Diego game when Jake Fisher peels off on the tackle eligible and gets like 40 yards down the sideline. I was like, finally, that jersey purchase paid off. So
they do
kudos
the,
to you.
They do the weirdest stuff with all, like Hugh constantly is just doing random stuff that means nothing. Like he'll line Andrew Whitworth up at slot receiver and then move him back in and just block it normally, or put him at fullback and then he'll step back up and just block a play normally. Like he does all these random things that really do nothing, but I think it's just designed to make the defense go, wait, what are they doing, for a split second before the snap, because it seems to be working.
And then all you have to do is, all you have to do, like 3 or 4 times during the season, is have, you know, Sanu throw a double pass or throw the ball to the tackle, or, you know, run an end around to Burkhead or something crazy like that, and then they have to respect it. So, I mean, I get it. I mean, I think Hugh's been really aggressive and creative this year, more so than he has been in the past when he's been in Cincinnati.
I agree.
Anyway, we should probably leave it there.
Yeah. Important things, though. James Harden, I saw on Twitter, was rocking vanillas in an NBA preseason game yesterday. Has JP and your father, of course, have they've started a new trend here for scorers that don't want to play defense?
I think my dad, James Harden, and JP McCura have a lot in common.
I would agree with that assessment.
Like they could probably sit down and rap for a couple hours about, you know, just sort of see what's cracking.
All right.
I would like to see that conversation.
As would I. Maybe we can get them together for a podcast. They'll be guest hosts one time. All right. Well, I think that does it for this edition of the Day in a Victory podcast. For Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.